The following message was given by Richard David Armstrong on Friday night, June 4th, 1954, at Big Sandy, Texas, USA. It was given on the weekend just before Pentecost.
The 11th chapter of Daniel is the longest prophecy anywhere in the Bible. It was written in 538 B.C., 538 years before the birth of Christ. And all of these things that are written here did not come to pass until about a little over 100 years later. Now, this prophecy is given in quite a lot of detail. And if you want any proof that the Bible is divinely inspired, I think that this chapter is one of the best proofs. Nobody, absolutely nobody, could, by any human means whatsoever, have written something so thorough as this, predicted it, and then had it happen just exactly as it said. And every last detail of this chapter came to pass just a little over 100 years later. Starts out, "Also I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I, stood to confirm and to strengthen him." This was written in 538 B.C. "And now I will show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia." You might take notes on this if you'd like. "Cambyses," C-A-M-B-Y-S-E-S, C-A-M-B-Y-S-E-S was the first. "Smerdis" was the second, S-M-E-R-D-I-S. "Darius the first," D-A-R-I-U-S, Darius the first was the third. And then "Xerxes," "and the fourth shall be far richer than they all," was Xerxes, X-E-R-X-E-S, X-E-R-X-E-S. And he did attack Greece, and by his strength through his riches he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia, or Greece. "And a mighty king shall stand up, that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will." Now the great king that rose up later out of this was Alexander the Great of the Greco-Macedonian Empire. "And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds." Alexander the Great was the greatest military man in history. They still teach his tactics in West Point. They still teach it to our army officers. He devised warfare as we know it today with armies that moved quickly, and that he was so wise in devising different weapons of destruction, for instance, a catapult and things like that for taking walled cities, that they declared him a genius, and he conquered the known world. He was 33 years old when he died. He began ruling, I believe, about the time he was 20, and he, with his army, conquered the entire world. He died of a drunken debauch in India. He conquered all of Egypt, all of North Africa. He conquered all of Macedonia and Greece, what is now Turkey, and Israel and Palestine and Lebanon and Syria and Iran and Iraq, and all out through Egypt. Took the entire world. By the time he was only 33 years old, then when he died, this four winds, that his kingdom should be broken and should be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and his posterity not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion, which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others beside those. Now when he died, four of his generals took over. He defeated, Alexander did, the Persians at the Battle of Issus. That's I-S-S-U-S, the Battle of Issus in 333 and the Battle of Arbela in 331. You should have those two dates because that is when he came into a world power. That is a time when Alexander the Great really started to rule the world. Now his empire was divided to four generals, plus a few other unimportant divisions. A man named Ptolemy, P-T-O-L-E-M-Y, P-T-O-L-E-M-Y, took Egypt. A man named Antipater, A-N-T-I-P-A-T-E-R, took Macedonia. Laomedon, L-A-O-M-E-D-O-N, took Syria, which is just north of Palestine. I wish I had a map here so you could see all of this. And Seleucus Nicator, S-E-L-E-U-C-U-S-N-I-C-A-T-O-R, Nicator, took Babylon. Now here Daniel was predicting that this was going to happen, and this is exactly what did happen about 100 years later. So he was to stand up. He was to be a great king to stand up. His dominion was to be broken and scattered to the four winds of the heaven, which it was under his four generals. It did not go to his posterity. He had a bastard son, a child that was born illegitimately. Nothing passed to that son. None of his dominion was ever given to him. Rather, he had lived with a number of women without marrying any of them. And he died merely because he so dissipated his body that his health went to pot. Now, and the king of the south, who became this Ptolemy Soter, P-T-O-L-E-M-Y Soter, S-O-T-E-R, shall be strong, and one of his princes, who was Seleucus Nicator, one of the four generals of Alexander the Great, and he shall be strong above him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. And in the end of years they shall join themselves together. For the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. Now, in the Bible language, as most of you have heard before, north and south refer to north and south of Jerusalem. North is Syria, and south is Egypt. And that's the way this works out here. To make an agreement. Now, that was a marriage agreement which took place between Antiochus II of Syria, Antiochus II of Syria, who was the king of the north, and Bernice, who was the daughter of the king of the south. Antiochus' first wife, in history now, this is what happened. Antiochus' first wife took vengeance by having Bernice slain, the Egyptians who attended her killed her son, and they murdered her son. The King James has a mistranslation here, as we'll find, and Antiochus was poisoned. Now that is what actually happened. You can dig this out of secular history, and I'll see how he foretold it here. And in the end of years they shall join themselves together. For the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north, Bernice coming to marry Antiochus II, to make an agreement, which was a marriage contract, the agreement that they had, joining these two nations together. But she shall not retain the power of the arm. Now that does not mean the power of an army, but the power of her descendancy. Her son was killed by the Egyptian attendants. Neither shall he stand nor his arm. In other words, her son was killed. He would not stand nor any of his offspring. But she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. Now all of these people, those that attended her, were killed. Those that strengthened her, her attendants from Egypt, were killed. Her son was killed, her husband was poisoned, and she died. but out of a branch of her roots. Now, a branch of her roots would be her father and mother. A branch would be a brother or sister. This happened to be her brother, who was Ptolemy, Ptolemy the third. Shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail. Now that is this Ptolemy the third conquering Syria. He was the brother of Bernice, who had married the king of the north. And shall also carry captives into Egypt, their gods, with their princes, with their precious vessels of silver and of gold, and he shall continue more years, or remain some years further than the king of the north. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. But his sons shall be stirred up. Now, let's see. His sons shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces. And one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress. Of the two sons of Seleucus II, one, who was Antiochus the Great, invaded Syria, Palestine, and he concludes a treaty. It was renewed with war in 217 B.C., and then he attacked several other fortresses near the border of Egypt. So his sons there, the king of the south, shall be moved with color and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north. He shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. Now this his here was Philopater of Egypt. He defeated the king of the north at a place called Raphia, R-A-P-H-I-A. And when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. Now, the Egyptians annexed Palestine to Egypt, but they made a rash treaty with Syria, and that dissipated their victory and made it as nil or nothing. Then Philopater persecuted thousands of Jews. Notice it's a thing that the Syrians did, a persecution of the Jews, in the city of Alexandria in Egypt, because he was struck with paralysis when trying to enter the temple at Jerusalem. Another case where God moved to strike a man down when he was doing something that was absolutely against the will of God, where he was disobeying God wantonly, and he was struck down with paralysis, then he spent the rest of his time persecuting the Jews. For the king of the north, in the 13th verse, shall return and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. King of the north was Antiochus the third. After 14 years, he assembled a great army to conquer Egypt, which had a weak king. And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. Now, Antiochus, the fulfilling of verse 15, momentarily occupied by an attack from Pergamum, they were attacking him, attacked Egypt in 198 B.C., and he defeated the Egyptian ally Scopas as a man named Panias, P-A-N-E-A-S, retook Palestine. This is all, it shouldn't be dry history to you. As a matter of fact, I'd like to see more of you taking notes to have this down so you'll know what this chapter is all about. This is really the one chapter in the Bible that proves, perhaps more than anything, that your prophecy is absolute. This was all written more than 100 years before it happened, and you can read, this is from Rawlinson's Ancient History, which is not obtainable now. You can't get it in any bookstore anywhere. But it is from secular history, not from by religious writers at all, proving that every last event that was foretold here took place. So the king of the north and so on shall come, which was verse 15. In verse 16, but he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land which by his hand shall be consumed. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. Now, Antiochus planned to conquer Egypt by trickery, and his daughter Cleopatra was given in marriage to a man named Ptolemy Epiphanes. This contract, or business deal, actually, is what it was. He was going to sell his daughter in marriage to make a compact. Appeared, or seemed to be, of uprightness and equal conditions. But it failed, and then Cleopatra aided her husband against her father. Her father sold her, you might say, in marriage to Ptolemy. So she married him, but it didn't work out. She turned on her father and helped her husband defeat him. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. After this shall he turn his face unto the isles, or coastlands, and shall take many. But a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach he shall cause it to turn upon him. That was Antiochus invading Asia Minor and taking the Aegean Islands, which are off the coast of between Greece and Italy. And a Roman general, Scipio, S-C-I-P-I-O, we hear a lot about him in history, in 190 B.C., causes the Syrian reproach to Rome to return on his own head, and Antiochus was overwhelmingly defeated in that year. Now notice, after this he shall turn his face to the coastlands, the isles, which he did. He invaded Asia Minor, and he took the Aegean Islands. A prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Roman General Scipio in 190 causes the Syrian reproach to Rome to return on his own head. Without his own reproach he shall cause it to turn upon him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. And that happened at Antiochus after returning to Antioch, which was a fort, is murdered in a town there by the people for plundering the temple to pay Roman indemnity. Now by this time the world was under Rome, and the circumstances of his death are not too well known. They say that he died a dozen different ways. Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes. in the glory of the kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. Now, we're getting down now to where we're coming to what's going to happen today. In present history, each of these prophecies has a dual meaning. Each of them has a dual fulfillment. I'm giving you now the history of when this was fulfilled in the past. Much of this has been fulfilled a second time with Mussolini and Hitler. You're going to see a few verses here later what is going to come to happen in the very near future. Now, verse 20, Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed neither in anger nor in battle. Heliodorus, Heliodorus, was sent by Seleucus the Fourth. There have been of Seleucus the Second and the Third and the Fourth and then of Philopater the Third and Fourth and Ptolemy the Third, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, and so on. And only the important ones are mentioned here. They're the ones that I'm mentioning because they are the ones who fulfilled this prophecy. The rest of them were inconsequential people that never amounted to anything. Heliodorus was sent by Seleucus the Fourth as a tax collector. The king was poisoned. King James here has a mistranslation, there shall arise one who shall send a tax collector. Not there shall send, it should not be here, then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes, or exactor as it has in the margin, but it should be, there shall arise one who shall send a tax collector according to the best ancient Hebrew manuscripts. Now, come down to verse 21, and in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries, or come in time of security. Now we're coming down to where it's beginning to talk about Hitler. If you'll notice, everything in this verse will apply directly to him. He fulfilled it in a dual manner, the second time, just as surely as it has been fulfilled before. Now this first vile person back there was Antiochus Epiphanes. You've heard a lot about him. You'll hear him preached about in a good number of sermons. Anybody who's touching on prophecy will mention his name because he's that important. Antiochus Epiphanes, that's spelled E-P-I-P-H-A-N-E-S. E-P-I-P-H-A-N-E-S, Antiochus Epiphanes. And with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him, and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. Now, let's see, after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. This small person, Antiochus Epiphanes, collects armies. He quelled all of his foes. A high priest, Onias, O-N-I-A-S, was replaced by Jason. He had the high priest then replaced. And that is where he took the Prince of the Covenant. It was not Christ here, but the high priest at that time. In the 23rd verse, Antiochus Epiphanes deals deceitfully with Rome and with the high priest. Now, Jason was replaced with a man named Menelaus, M-E-N-E-L-A-U-S. This man is the type of the final beast dictator in Europe. Now, Hitler has in many ways fulfilled a lot of this. If you will see that he was, before him came Bismarck, who was a raiser of taxes, first man to unify Germany, to make it a united kingdom and a united nation of all the various independent states that they have had in Germany. he, you might call him a raiser of taxes, or say that he sent other people to raise taxes. He was destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. And in his estate would stand up this vile person to whom they should not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and attain the kingdom by flatteries. Now, Hitler, I'm not sure but what this may have another fulfilling a little later on, but Hitler, if you remember, back in 1933, obtained Germany, his power in Germany. He became chancellor. He did not become dictator. They had the president, old von Hindenburg, who was, well, he'd been president of the Weimar Republic, and he was a weak and feeble old man. Actually, in reading about him, I feel quite sorry for him. He was a very stern man who had some very high ideals, but he didn't know how to put them in practice too well. Hitler came in, and by every deceitful means possible, made speeches all over the face of Germany, promised the Germans everything on the face of the earth. He made every promise conceivable to the people, and by flattery, by most deceitful, vile type of means, got himself not elected. They held an election, and Hitler lost. Two of them, and I believe three, Hitler lost. He could not win an election in Germany. But by playing dirty politics, so to speak, and by his vile, sneaky manner, he came in and took possession of Germany, and yet not of his own power. Then, later on, with the arms of a flood, he did overflow all over Europe. Now, the 24th verse, he shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. Now that happened in the past that Antiochus, who had conquered all of these surrounding regions in Asia Minor, distributed the wealth, and then he issued a lot of propaganda. He was a completely vile person. Completely. And he took wealth and he distributed it around to people, and then he more or less double-crossed them. He threatened everybody, and he was quite a funny type of person. And he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. So Antiochus Epiphanes reduced Egypt, or took it, in four campaigns, beginning in the year 173 B.C. Now, the forecast devices were of bribery and propaganda. You find that they used propaganda quite effectively back in those days by sending people amongst those of the nation that they were going to fight in Egypt and spreading false news and false doctrines and telling lies. And then when they had the people in a point where they wanted them, they'd just go in and take over. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him. Those that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. Now, Ptolemy Philometor of Egypt is betrayed to the Syrians and made prisoner in guise of friendship, because conqueror and prisoner are uncle and nephew. The Egyptians in Alexandria make Ptolemy's brother the king. In verse 27, and both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. The uncle and the nephew at the banquet were trying to deceive each other. It sounds like Hitler and Mussolini and some of the banquets they used to have. The Then shall he return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant. He shall do exploits and return to his own land. And at the time appointed he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. In verse 28, Antiochus returns and persecutes Jews who rejoice upon hearing a false report of his death when he was not dead. Then the king of the north returned to Egypt when his brothers learned of the uncle's treachery. The Romans demanded a withdrawal, and Rome makes Egypt a protectorate. Now, verse 30, for the ships of Chittim shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the holy covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. Now the ships of Chittim, I believe that is better spelled with a K, was the Roman fleet. And renegade Jews joined with the Gentile Syrians to destroy what remained of true religion in Palestine. There was, by this time, very little true religion in this world. There were very few. You see, this is getting down now to where we're just a little more than 100 years before the birth of Christ. Judaism was not God's true religion by any means. The Jews had wandered off so far by this time, they'd introduced all their own laws. They had been lost from God's true laws so many different times. They'd lost the Sabbath and finally gotten back to it, and they made themselves strict rules, rules that made the Sabbath a yoke of bondage to them, so strict that no man could really keep it. And they went through rituals that no longer meant anything to them. Now, although the word, the Logos, or spokesman of God, which is Christ, all through the Old Testament had been with their forefathers, and if they had obeyed, they could still have been led by Christ. But they rather chose to reject him and go the other way. Now, these laws were given for the very purpose of teaching these people that God was a loving God, that he was kind, and that they should be obedient to him. But people read these laws today, and they think they're so stern and harsh, and they think that the whole world has come to believe that God is unmerciful, that he is anything but love, that he's as harsh as he can be, and that he wants nothing but misery for all mankind. That's actually the idea that has been put across. It's the idea that the Catholic Church keeps pushing forward all of the time. Their saints, how many of you heard this broadcast they had from Rome? Good. I hope a few of you did listen into that. You should be awake to these things and listening to them when they happen. Now, they had this broadcast that came from Rome. They made Pope Pius the 10th, as they call him, Pope Pius. Anyway, he was number 10 of the popes recently. They made him a saint. I read quite a bit about it, and the whole idea, actually, of saints. You people are saints when you come to understand the true Bible meaning of the word. A saint, as you find all of these books in the New Testament, where Paul was writing his epistles to the churches, to the saints, to those members of the church of God at Corinth, and all of these other places who were called to be saints unto Jesus Christ our Lord. In other words, a true person, a person who is living a Christian life, struggling with himself in order to overcome self, to build character, the purpose for which we were born, is a saint. Now, the Catholics have this idea of worshiping dead people. The whole idea was that in order to become a saint, it's really quite foolish. This Leo had to perform four miracles after he died. In
And of course, they claim that he did perform these miracles. One of them was a woman, or a man, I forget which, I believe it was a woman in Naples, Italy, who was dying of a lung cancer or something. And when her husband got all stirred up about it, he went out and got some flowers off of the grave of this pope and took a picture of the pope, put it on her chest, danced around her, and thumbed his beads and said so many Our Fathers and Hail Marys all night. The next morning, they say she was healed. Therefore, the pope, after he was dead and in his grave, did it. That's a miracle that he performed. And now, the Catholic doctrine and dogma on this idea, when you come to understand it, is that he is in heaven. Not bodily, only in spirit. Mary has gone in body. They teach that Mary, the mother of Christ, is just like you and me, in a physical body form, up in heaven. They can't tell you where heaven is, but that is their dogmatic teaching, that she has bodily ascended to heaven, and that means flesh and bones, too. Now, the whole idea of their saints is that they're a dead person who lived a good life, and they were very righteous. They never did any wrong. They've performed at least four miracles after they're dead, and they are now able to intercede with God. And do you know why? Because God is not powerful enough. He hates the world. He's gone off somewhere. He looks down on this world and sort of turns his face away and doesn't want to have anything to do with it. He hates the world. He wants to see the world unhappy. But if you get enough saints prayed up into heaven that would intercede and plead and beg for God to be merciful with this world, that perhaps we can have some peace. Maybe God would then leave us alone. Bothers too much. That's what that doctrine and teaching is. I sort of got off the subject here. But that is what happened in this particular case, and we should be keeping up with the news as it happens this way and these things, and I hope you people will listen in to any further broadcasts of that type. Make it a point to read your paper every day and find out about those things and listen to them. I tell you, the time is shorter than you think. And when you come to realize why you were born, why you're here tonight, why you're here in body on this earth at all, is the flesh and blood that you are, the person that is you. God gave every last one of us our life for a purpose. And that purpose was to build in us, as you heard my father say so many times over the radio, the chance of being born into the family of God. Now, there's only one way you can ever be born into that family, and that is by building enough character that God can plant the seed of His Holy Spirit into you. You are not a begotten child of God until you have the Holy Spirit. And that is the seed that impregnates you, so to speak. It impregnates you and gives you a chance to grow, even as an unborn child grows, till it is born. And that birth, the actual birth, will come with the second coming of Christ. Now, the whole purpose of our being alive and of our being here on this earth is to build character. And how do you build character? There is only one way you can build character, and that is by taking your own faults out, each and every one of us, looking in the mirror, realizing what those faults are, and overcoming them. Now, we've got to do that, or we're not going to be blessed. We will not remain the Church of Christ, or God's true church. We can't be the body of Christ unless we're going to pattern our lives after Him. Merely keeping the Sabbath, merely keeping these holy days, and doing those things, there are a lot of unconverted people that can do those things because they see it as an argument. A lot of people will keep the Sabbath because they see it as an argument out of the Bible. But they've never surrendered themselves to God. They still don't know why they were born. They still don't know what the purpose of people being put on this earth was for, what it's all about. Now, no idle business, really. It's quite serious. And the most serious thing for each one of us as an individual is overcoming ourselves. It isn't anything you're going to do all at once. There's not a one of you here tonight, but what? Sins. Not a one of you. Any church that says that it is made up of members who are holy and righteous and who commit no sin whatsoever, never transgress God's law in any way, well, I would dare to call those people liars. I can turn to enough verses in my Bible, and I know where to turn to them to bring out things that true Christians must have that I know those people don't have. They'd have to be more perfect than they are to even brag about their own righteousness, which is one of the greatest faults you can have. That you can only build character by learning from the experience of your life, the faults and errors that you make from day to day, and by learning to overcome those things and to grow in the grace of God and in the knowledge of His law, and as you grow in that knowledge, then to put it to use and to make it a part of you. Now, actually, Christ, when you stop to think about it, Jesus Christ, our Messiah and Savior, was the law of God personified, wasn't He? He never broke a point of it. He had perfect patience. He had perfect love. He never got mad at anybody or let his anger run away with him. He always had perfect patience. He stood up under everything that anybody ever said to him. He never shouted back at them. Never let anything like that run away with him. How many of us are able to do those things? That's practically impossible for us today. It isn't impossible for us either. But I mean, you'll have to go an awfully long way to find somebody that does it. And yet, it's what we're all to strive for. It's nothing that we can just say, well, I'm unable to do it, and oh, that's so hard that I couldn't, and then forget about it. Well, let's go on with this. In the 31st verse, an arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice. They shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. Now here is one thing. When we see, we are told that when we see the abomination of desolations take place, they were told then to flee to the mountains, to get out of Jerusalem, because destruction was coming. We are told that when that happens again, that is the sign that Jesus Christ is coming almost momentarily. That means that within the next few days or weeks, you can look for the return of Jesus Christ. When this happens again, it's going to happen again. The Bible clearly shows that it must happen again. That was the 31st verse. This took place then at the climax of war. Also, you'll find that in Daniel 8, verses 11 to 14. An idol of Jupiter Olympus was set up. That idol of Jupiter Olympus is the same one that they call St. Peter now. I'm pretty sure that it is the same one that they call St. Peter that's in the Vatican in Rome. I'll see that this summer. I'm going to go down to the Vatican again, and we'll be undoubtedly in St. Peter's Cathedral, as they call it there. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. Now, many Jews rejected the covenant of God, and they had the Maccabean revolt. And if you notice that when this comes again, such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. Something that you're going to see start to take place in this world again before too long. A lot of miracles that are going to take place, Not here in the form of healings. We have had several miraculous healings since I saw you last, of people that were here with us. Several that have been out to visit us in California since we were here last, that were in quite critical condition, and that have been healed of various things. But the time is coming now, before very long, when you're going to start to see miracles being worked in front of the entire world. And these things that are prophesied in Revelation, and as it says here, that the people who know their God shall be strong and do exploits. Various miracles are going to be performed, and the devil is also going to give power to his chief agent, who is going to profess to be able to read signs of the times and to read great wonders. There's a lot of great swamis and fortune tellers have always been able to try to do and said they have been able to do, and they're going to fool the people with these things. Enough so, and they will be able to perform such miracles that the very elect, you know, would be fooled if it were possible. And some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white. In other words, to make the body. And that is something that undoubtedly will happen now in the next few years. I don't know how many years, but that's something that we might as well realize is going to happen to this church. It is going to happen to the church that is the affianced bride of Jesus Christ. Some of these tribulations that are coming, and believe me, they are coming, I think you can see that from what the Bible does say, some are going to fall. That means some who are members of the church are not going to be strong enough. They're going to fall so that the body itself may be purged out of all those weak ones, of all those who are not strong enough, so that it may be made pure and white to be presented to Christ as His bride when He comes. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet shall they fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity, by spoil many days. Now let's go back here. Verse 33-35, the church of God to the time of the end. The Jews don't know God. The Jews only know what the Jews have set up in their own laws and what they think they will make them righteous by their own doings. And even the persecution that they are suffering does not make them righteous. They use that as an excuse. I've talked to Jews who say that because they are persecuted, that makes them righteous and proves, therefore, that they are the true worshipers of God, yet they deny Christ. Now when they shall fall, they shall be helped with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. That's one thing that's pretty hard to overcome. Flattery, that's one thing that a lot of people fall for. Some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. And the king shall do according to his will. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that this is determined shall be done. For that is determined shall be done. That is going to come to pass. It's something that I think you can see how it will be fulfilled. He will exalt himself and magnify himself above every god and speak marvelous things against the God of gods and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. And the accomplishment of that indignation will be when the abomination of desolations takes place, and they are going to make this statue to speak by some means or another. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, and the God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and precious stones and pleasant things. Now let's go back and get this. The 36th verse, the king is the ruler of the north, as this took place before the birth of Christ now. This has already happened, been fulfilled, taken place once before Christ was born. The ruler of the north and the ruler of Syria. It is not Syria because Rome occupied Syria, and therefore the real true power of the land that occupied the land of Syria was Rome. So Rome is at this time now the king of the north. This describes the Roman emperors and the successive revivals to our day. The emperors exalt themselves. It came down to a time when, finally, the Roman emperors became the popes. It just turned into that. Until you come back to Mussolini, who was actually a little pipsqueak in the setup of the whole thing. Now, in verse 37, here, neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all. A proper translation, neither shall he regard gods of his fathers. The Romans never knew the true God. The desire of women is Tammuz, which you'll find in Ezekiel 8:14. You can look that up if you want to, who was a false Christ. Emperors rejected authority of false Christ. In the 38th verse, the translation is, and in his estate shall he honor the God of forces or God of fortresses. The pagans had no God of fortress, only a goddess. She was Semiramis, the type of the fallen church throughout the Bible. The type of the fallen church. Therefore, the male head of the fallen church is the God of fortresses, and he claims to be God. If you'd like to look this up, you'll find a reference in 2 Thessalonians 2, 3-10. We'll help explain some of that. Now, in verse 39 here, the King James is rather obscure. Let's see. In verse 39, thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange God, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and shall divide the land for gain. Now it means that with the help of the popes, the emperors gained victories. Those who acknowledge him, he increased with honor, or in other words, it's the same thing as a feudalistic system. Anyone who would honor him, he would increase with riches. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. Now the king of the south was Ethiopia. King Menelik defeated the Italians in 1896. And Mussolini defeated Ethiopia in 1934 by aerial warfare. Something that these poor tribesmen in Ethiopia knew nothing about. They had only swords to fight with. If you remember, it was after the advent of the airplane. It was a new thing at the time. It had been tried out in the Spanish Civil War. And Mussolini wanted to try his air force out. They tried it out in Spain, and so what did he do? He went down to Ethiopia and said he was going to take it over. And he went out against a lot of bushmen that had nothing but swords to fight with, and he bombed them and machine gunned them from airplanes and perfected his art of aerial warfare by doing it. Took over Ethiopia. Now, we have come to a point here where everything that has happened has been duly fulfilled the second time. All of this is past. Up, except for some of these things here where the abomination of desolation that has not been fulfilled. But you're going on. Everything now from verse 41 on is in the future, is yet to happen. Now, Palestine conquered, Transjordan will escape the Russian threat, Europe attacking first, and the Vatican, as it shows in the last part of this, to be moved on into Palestine. He shall enter also into the glorious land, or Palestine, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon. Three small countries, or tribes, which were in the land of Palestine and are still there today. The land, they call it the land of Ammon, Edom and Moab and Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. But tidings out of the east and the north shall trouble him, which shall be Russia. Tidings out of Russia shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain Jerusalem, yet he shall come to his end and none shall help him. And you'll find that the 17th chapter of Revelation explains how that will be fulfilled. It tells in a little greater detail how this last half of this is going to be fulfilled. Well, that finishes that. If any of you would like to have some more of these to study for yourselves, I can give it to you again later. If you want to see me privately, you can copy some of these references that I have down showing you who these different things are. I had not, as I said, prepared anything tonight, and I thought we might just take a little Bible study. I hadn't prepared any service. Actually, I might just say that I had expected Marion McNair to be here, and I've been so busy that I haven't had much time in preparation of anything. However, I will have a regular service tomorrow at 2:30, isn't it? The services have been beginning here. 2:30. Pardon? 2. All right, then we'll begin service tomorrow at 2:00, as usual. We'll have the Sabbath service here at 2:00, and we will have services on Sunday. Try and have a service on Sunday afternoon, and then there will be a service at 10:00. On the day of Pentecost, which is Monday, 10:00 in the morning, and then again by, don't you think, 2:30 in the afternoon to give a little more time for the kitchen and everything, I suppose, 2:30. We'd better make that in the afternoon on Monday. I'd like to tell you people a little, we've been just finishing up school out in Pasadena. We've all been very busy. I've been teaching and I've had my final examinations to give and to correct and everything, and trying to get away. I had not known that I was going to be here with you. I said goodbye to most of you at the feast when I was here, thinking that I would be in New York by now, but I got my ticket rearranged, and so I'm able to be here until Pentecost on Monday, and then Tuesday morning, Roderick Meredith will be here Sunday evening. And you will hear from him on Monday. He will speak to you. Then he and I are leaving together for Europe from here. I've already said goodbye to all the folks out at home, and we will leave from here and fly from Dallas to New York Tuesday morning. We get in there about 3:15 in the afternoon, and the very next morning at 8:00, we will board the Queen Elizabeth and go right on over to Southampton, England. We're going to be there until we come back here for the Feast of Tabernacles. We're flying directly from London to Dallas the very day that evening. We have the first meeting here of the Feast of Tabernacles on October the 11th. So we will be over there all summer. For some of you who I know this will mean something to, the wisdoms I recognize, that there will be a minister in your town, Wichita Falls, this summer. Raymond Cole will be there, and he will also be down around Corpus Christi, and Alice, and George West, and through that region. There is a baptizing tour out now consisting of Gerald Waterhouse and George Meeker, who was here at the Feast of the Passover with me, and Raymond McNair, who has gone with them to help them get started, and then Raymond McNair will later take Kenneth Swisher with him, and there will be those two tours going out. Now, for this summer, Mr. Hay will spend the most of his time, I believe, out in Pasadena. He's got an awful lot to do. They're going to hold some summer classes there, some courses in Bible and in history. And we're trying to do what we can out there for some of the members of the church to get them to come in and take some of these things, some courses in history, some courses in English, in grammar, in penmanship, in writing, and a number of things that, frankly, a lot of the members of the congregation have not had. They don't know how to study history and to get the real, true benefit that they should out of their Bible study, because they've never learned how to take these things from secular history and apply them as directly as the Bible interprets this world and what life is all about, and to just use it that way and know what it is. And I know, frankly, that I think I can say that most of you here probably don't have a very good basic understanding in world history. And it's something that you should study. You should see to it that you get books and things and understand these things so that you study and are up on it, so that you know something about it. We're supposed to grow. We're supposed to grow spiritually, and certainly that means mentally too, you know. The mind should grow. Body stops growing, I guess, by my age or before, but the mind should keep right on growing until the day you die. And too many people do not let their minds grow. They get to a certain point in life where they're able to earn a living, and then they just bog down. They get in a rut. Well, that's as far as I ever need to be able to go. They're not progressing. They're not studying. Trying to get ahead, to really grow mentally, as they should. And that's something that we should keep right on doing until the very day that we die. It's as much a problem for me. Really, it's a problem for me, and it has been, to get to study my Bible as much as I'd like to. And along, I know, with all of these other subjects, and yet we do get around to these things if we force ourselves. And sometimes we just have to do that. Have you had Friday night meetings here before of Bible study groups? We have out in Pasadena every Friday night. We meet, usually there's around 100 of us there in the college library. It's a very informal meeting, just like I've tried to keep this more or less. We never preach a sermon or sing any songs, and usually Mr. Hay or myself just sit down with the group in a chair and talk to them. We don't stand up and preach at all. We just open the Bible and go through these subjects of history and various things like this, and have a Bible study and try to answer a few questions and things like that every Friday night. It's been a wonderful experience for me and for, I'm sure, all of the brethren out there. They've enjoyed it and been able to grow very much from these things, and a lot of them have learned now how to take some of these things and study them and retain them and use them so that it has really been a good benefit to them.
This message is provided by the Bible Study website at address www.biblestudy.org and Barnabas Ministries. Bible Study. You have questions, the Bible has answers. Message introduction and closing by Dave Williams, digitizing and editing by Alan Ruth, and post-production by Mike Summers.